And having successful books has enabled me to hustle less. I mean, that's just the truth, is that I've made some money writing fiction and now can be a little choosier. I don't just hustle nonstop. And that has been an incredible boon to my creative life.
Welcome back to Not Too Busy to Write. I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach. Today, I'm in conversation with Catherine Newman, New York Times bestselling author of Sandwich and Wreck. Catherine and I talked on the podcast a few years ago when her debut, We All Want Impossible Things, came out. Catherine and I laughed so hard in that episode that my editing software could barely cope with it. And it is such a great pleasure to have Catherine back again to talk about her latest novel, Wreck. Wreck revisits Rocky and her family and is a tragicomic look at the anxieties of midlife. We talk about writing superstitions, why Catherine doesn't ever want to have to write a novel, what success as a novelist has really brought her, cutting and hilarious one-star reviews, and the joys of Substack. Wreck is out now, and all of the links are in the show notes. If you are looking for more accountability and community as a writer who is working on a long project like a novel, a memoir, or indeed a Substack, then take a look at The Fold. We have weekly audios straight into your podcast feed, co-writing sessions, writing challenges, and a community space where you can chat with fellow writers. We also have monthly workshops led by guest experts. This month, award-winning author Claire Lynch is taking a workshop on researching for fiction and non-fiction. The Fold is £20 a month. Cancel at any time, and the link is in the show notes. Enjoy the episode. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
It is so lovely to see you again. I love having a guest back twice. I feel like we can go even deeper the second time.
I like it too. It's just comfortable and I don't have all my like new person nervousness.
Well, I was re-listening to the episode we did. I realized it was 3 years ago. I couldn't believe it was 3 years ago.
Wow.
I know. I re-listened to it when I was prepping for this. Oh my goodness, Catherine, we laughed like pretty much nonstop the whole time.
Were we talking about hospice and laughing?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. We were talking about death and laughing and laughing and laughing.
Yeah, that tracks.
But the last time we spoke, so it was We All Want Impossible Things. I think it hadn't come out in the UK when we spoke. It had come out in the US, I think, just, but it hadn't come out here. Since then, you're on your third adult novel. You're a Sunday Times bestseller, a New York Times bestseller. I mean, congratulations. So much has happened since we've spoken.
Thank you so much.
I was thinking about what we talked about last time. And one of the things we talked about was, you know, the freelance writer's life. And the kind of hustle of that, and in many ways, how that was really good training ground. But at the same time, you treated writing novels quite separately. You protected them. And your worst sort of fear was a two-book deal. I'm curious, do you still feel the same now, like sort of three more adult novels in now? Do you still feel the same?
That's a good question. I still have not done a two-book deal, and I don't want to have to write a novel. Like, I can't imagine being creative from that place. That said, just full disclosure, I sold Wreck when it was only half written, and even that was very nerve-wracking to me. Because I'm so superstitious and I like to write a book and nobody even knows I'm working on it. And then I submit it. And a friend of mine was like, just in a mercenary advice way, she was like, sell this new book while Sandwich is still a bestseller.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, that's got to be good advice. And my agent thought it was. And so we sold Wreck when it was just about half written. And then I had a day of having like placebo effect writer's block, where I basically was like, oh, I have now produced the thing I was afraid of, where I'm not gonna be able to finish the book. And it only lasted a day and then I was okay.
Oh, that's so interesting. So now that you've had this experience, do you think you might feel slightly differently about novel writing in terms of having hard deadlines and stuff? Or do you want to keep it the same, like keep yourself quite free compared to the freelance work?
Again, it's such a good question. I always appreciate the nitty gritty actual like writer's life questions, because it's not like I don't live in an ethereal like bubble of my art. I really am like paying bills and figuring out how to live and how to balance, you know, like work for money with other kinds of soul nourishing things, you know, getting invitations too. It's like balancing what do I do without being paid to do it? And what do I do because it's going to make my life better? So it's a lot of different things. I'm hustling. Last time I talked to you, I was still really in the hustle of the freelance life, and having successful books has enabled me to hustle less. I mean, that's just the truth, is that I've made some money writing fiction and now can be a little choosier. I don't just hustle nonstop. And that has been an incredible boon to my creative life.
So it's essentially just bought you a little bit of space.
That's almost exactly how I would put it. It's bought me a little bit of space and a little bit of, just like, rather than being flattened up against the freelance wall where everything everyone throws at me, I'm like catching it in every hand I've got. I'm like, oh, maybe I'll do that. And oh, maybe this one I won't do, which is, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I always, if I turn something down, which is still almost never, I picture crawling back and begging for it. I picture the scenario where I am on my hands and knees being like, I'm sorry, I thought I was all that. Like, I do want to write this piece about this, like, kidney donation, whatever. In the meantime, I'm just being, like, a little choosier.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you, because the way you described it last time as not being ever able to say no, have you been able to practice saying no a little bit? And is it getting a little bit easier, or it still feels really challenging to say no to things?
I mean, how do you feel? Are you able to say no to things? I'm just curious.
I had to say no to a speaking thing this spring recently, where I didn't say no initially. I took the meeting.
It gets harder and harder digging out.
And I really realized that it was going to be so much work, and it would have been lovely, but the pay wasn't very high. But there was very good reasons why it wasn't very high, and I wouldn't want to take too much because it was charity that was running it. But at the same time, weighing up how to spend your time, it's so difficult, isn't it?
It is so difficult. And I just, so that kind of thing where you get in too deep too quickly and then you have to say no, but you're like in the hole of having suggested you might do it. And you're like, oh, now they have to contact somebody else and start all over. I really have that. And usually, honestly, because everyone doing all the work everywhere is women, it's usually a woman who's asking you, right? And they're asking you and they're not really offering to pay you a lot. And then you have to say no to this woman who's going to have to talk to her team, who's probably all women, half of them volunteers. I mean, it's all just so difficult. Like in the U.S., this is different from there. If you volunteer, and I'm saying volunteer, to be a conversation partner with a writer at a bookstore or an event, that is an unpaid gig.
Always, is it?
Always.
Guess here it is often paid. Yeah. I mean, not well paid necessarily.
Right.
But,
but at least nominally paid. Yeah, here it is. Paid. You do it because you're a woman and because you say yes to everything, and or because you love the writer, or because.
Yeah. And because someone else has done it for you. Right. So you're like, someone's done it to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the original question of saying no, I just for the first time ever have contracted with the speakers agency who is now handling all the initial requests. And I was loath to do it because I honestly feel like accessibility is part of my way of moving through the world. Like, if you want to reach out to me, just reach out to me. I will always write you back. Like, I don't think of myself as like unapproachable, but when they were trying to talk me into contracting with them, they were like, what could you better use that time for that you spend crafting emails saying you can't do something?
Yeah.
They were like, we're here to say no for you. And I was like, that is so appealing. Like, that's the main.
Sign me up.
That is the main reason I'm doing it, is yeah. so that I don't have to spend my morning being like, oh, that sounds so great. I wish you the very best with it. Like,
yeah, this is so true. And in fact, I do this podcast completely on my own. And one day, if I ever can afford to have someone help me with it, that is the job they'll do. Because I try always to respond when I get emails from authors and PRs, and I always try really hard to respond. But I know something slipped through. I can't even tell you how many emails I get a day. I'm sure you're exactly the same, right?
Right. And you want to be like, oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Best luck.
I changed laptops earlier this year, or late last year. And it started to try and load all of my old emails when I did it, right? I had to stop it. Anyway, so what I ended up doing was going and deleting a whole lot, like, as I just never delete things.
Same.
Was looking, yeah, okay, good, right? Because there, I know there are people out there that spend their time deleting, and I'm like,
never.
How do you have the time?
Hundreds of, also I often have to look something up.
Look something up, exactly. Well, so this was what was interesting. I popped into like 2018 to find some emails, because I was a bit like, I think it was when I was maybe like getting an agent or something, and I wanted to save those emails. You know, it felt like, a big thing to save.
Yeah.
And I looked at a day's worth of emails I was getting in 2018 versus a day's worth of emails I'm getting in 2026. I'm literally getting maybe 15 times the amount of email now.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, no wonder my head wants to explode.
Because you're just absolutely bombarded.
I mean, like, I sometimes feel really guilty because something's come from one of my kids' school that I was supposed to sign. And then some great PR person that I have a really good relationship with emails me and I miss it. And I realize a lot of the time it's because of the volume. Anyway, sorry, we just totally sidetracked there.
But no, not at all. But I just want to tell you, in terms of looking at stuff, my agent just said, do you remember the first conversation we ever had over email? I found an email from her from 2004 in which she said, I've just finished your amazing book. And I write back, I read the word book and burst into tears. Because I had sent her just like, what I thought of as pages. Anyway, thank God I don't delete anything.
I know.
It's all I'm saying.
Very smart. Very, very smart. Very smart. Let's talk about Rec. I was so delighted that we were coming back to Rocky again and her absolutely incredible family. And I would love to, first of all, just hear about, when did you know you were coming back to Rocky and you were going to revisit? Because she is, for those who don't know, is the protagonist of Sandwich as well, your second book. So yeah, tell us a little bit about what that looked like, when you knew she was still there for you.
Yeah. I mean, the truth about Rocky, obviously, is that she's always there, if you know what I mean. I mean, she, it lives in the bulk of my brain. But so this story, and it's not apocryphal, it's really true, is when I was finishing Sandwich, I had this idea for a different book that I thought of as having a big plot, which is very funny if you've read Rec. It does not, in the event, have a big plot. It has a very subtle, weird, small plot, like Sandwich. But I thought of it as a plot. I was like, oh, I have an idea for a totally different kind of book that's going to be plot-driven for the first time in my life. I'm going to write a thriller, you know, in the event, spoiler alert, didn't write a thriller, wrote another exactly domestic book. And as I started writing it, and I was like, it's going to have different characters. I just pictured it being written like a normal book. And then I lasted like a day writing it that way. And then immediately it was Rocky talking to Willa. Like the whole thing immediately devolved into those characters. And it seemed foolish to fight that. I mean, to work against something that felt like, oh, actually the story I want to tell is not the plot story. It's the interpersonal dynamics again. So here we are.
I would like, first of all, thank you. Thank you for bringing us back to Rocky. I would love to hear, because presumably then you had were you still writing right when Sandwich went out in the world and you started to hear readers' response to Rocky? So how did that interaction go between, you know, because so often people write standalone books and that book and that character is put away when you start interacting with readers and how they respond to protagonists. Oh, so what was that like?
It's funny because, of course, the problem with starting another book with the same set of characters before that book is in the world is like, if nobody likes these characters in Sandwich, I'll be offering more. It would be like, you know, if there's like a roast on your plate and someone's like, would you like a second helping? And you're like, I literally can't even eat this one. Like, stop. So I was starting to read these Goodreads reviews. My daughter, who is the funniest person I know, she forwards me all my one-star Goodreads reviews, and they are so crushing and often so hilarious. They're just like, my favorite Sandwich review was grinding and plotless. It was just a three-word review. That was all it said, and I loved it so much. Like, I want a tattoo or have it on my face, grinding and plotless. But anyway, so my daughter's sending me these one-star reviews, and I'm like, I have made a grave tactical error. People hate Rocky. And the really funny thing is when people give Wreck a one-star review, they often say, I hated Rocky so much in Sandwich, and I hate her even more in Wreck. And I'm like, girl,
what are you doing here?
I was like, protect your time. Why are you reading this book?
I have to say, that is a them problem. You know?
I want to make a PSA that's like, don't, if you hated a book in a series, don't read the next one. Just give yourself a break. Anyway, so I had a little crisis of faith about it. And then, as it turned out, Sandwich did really well and sold well. And so then I felt much more confident about Wreck. Yeah. And it was okay. But it was a little nerve-wracking. And also, it's hard to tell what will feel comfortingly familiar to people and what will feel sticky, what will feel like a bit. Mm-hmm. And that, I just tried not to think about it too much. You know, I tried not to like overthink it. I just wrote it the way I wanted to write it and hoped for the best.
Because I know we're familiar with these characters, and actually the familiarity for me is the joy, a lot of the joy.
I'm so glad to hear it, truly.
Yeah, it really is. But at the same time, they're quite different shaped novels in many ways. Like, the shape of them feels very different.
That's the plot. You're talking about the massive plot of Wreck. No, well, tell me more. Tell me what you mean.
Well, so, because I feel like in Sandwich, you know, set over 1 week and obviously moving around in time the way that we did, and through Rocky's kind of reminiscence of her experiences around fertility and children and what she's going through in menopause. But in Wreck, it's over a longer period of time, and there's these sort of two stories, these two kind of intertwining stories that are unrelated, but at the same time sort of feed off each other, the anxieties that develop and over that course of the year. So one of them obviously is this sort of escalating health problem, this mysterious health problem that Rocky's experiencing, but the other is this wreck that happens at the beginning of the novel. And it felt to me like, so they felt like quite different shape books in many ways. But the thing I loved about The Shape of Wreck was that it's the anxiety that sort of propels you through the story in a way. And And that just feels like midlife to me in so many ways.
I really appreciate you saying that. I mean, that is obviously my personal experience of midlife is kind of, sorry, that's my cat meowing, is hopping from thing to thing. Like my brain skipping from thing to thing in a very anxious way. And rec is definitely about that, as you say, like about, you know, Rocky knows about loss and knows that there is more loss coming for her and doesn't really know what shape it's going to take. And that is, I think, what that book's about for me is sort of hold Rocky trying to learn to hold her worry and uncertainty about what's going to happen next without it just subsuming everything. So I was trying to write that book about that, like about, I really feel like midlife has been this very, I mean, I want to say zen without being a cliche, but where like you really, there's just this, you know, there's just today. That feeling of like we can't forestall grief through worry. That's always the myth my brain produces is that if I worry enough, I'll be protected. And that's never true.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, you know, like Rocky is going through some, you know, very ordinary but very difficult life challenges. She's recently lost her mother. Her father is living with her again. And even though they're happy about that, that brings a lot of uncertainty about what the future is going to look like. And then, of course, she's got adult children who are experiencing all kinds of challenges that she can't control or protect them from. And it's interesting, I think, what is so lovely about the way you write is that I feel when I'm with your characters that I can also do the ordinary difficult things.
Oh, thank you for that.
There's something about the way in which you use humor and the way Rocky's mind works and that just it's feels possible to live with all the things that you know are going to be coming. Like we know these things are coming for us, don't we?
We do, yeah. It sometimes is possible and sometimes it feels absolutely impossible. You know, where you can't, I mean, this is the call, what, you know, you would call the call to mindfulness, but every now and then I think this is totally confessional. So just meet me halfway on this, but every now and then I will be so overwhelmed by what needs to be done in my life, in this moment of my life, especially caring for my aging parents. I'll be so overwhelmed with the work of it, the heartbreak of it, all of it, that I think, I wish I could fall asleep and wake up on the other side of this. I think, like, I'll just be dead. There's no other side of this. Like, it's just this.
It's just this. It's just this. And actually, I wanted to also bring up this thing that you write towards the end of the book that Rocky reflects on this idea of, like, am I going to think back on this year as, oh, that was a hard year, or am I going to look back and think that was the beginning? And I have had that thought, oh my goodness, so many times. The first time I remember hearing that thought was my mother died when I was 22, so I was just out of uni. It was young. But that so young. Same year, two of my close friends from high school, one of their fathers died of cancer and another one had a stroke and survived and very luckily survived for like another 15 or 20 years. But I remember that third incident happening, that stroke happening, and thinking, oh, this is just life now. you know, this is just it. And I was 22 and I remember thinking, oh, this is just what life is like now.
And you're like, I got another 60 years of this.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not quite like there really
no,
are.
It's not.
But yeah, but that realizing that was a bad year.
I was able to look back on that and be like, okay, that was a tough year.
That was a hard year.
Yeah.
Not the beginning of that forever and ever. I know I had a moment once where I sat with my daughter in a doctor's waiting room and they were trying to diagnose. She had a lump like in her rib cage that turned out to be of no consequence, but we were in a like diagnostic hellhole for maybe 5 months where they couldn't
get a long time. Yeah.
Right. And I remember when we were meeting with the surgeon for the last time, I was sitting with her in my lap and I thought, am I going to look back at this moment as the moment when we blissfully still didn't know what we were in for? Or am I going to look back and be like, whew, that turned out to be okay? You know, just that feeling of almost like, I mean, my husband's a philosopher, so I'm always like, it's Schrodinger's cat, but like Schrodinger's diagnostic moment, like where it could go either way. And you're in that suspended moment of not really knowing what's going to happen next. And I think Rocky's like illness is that, where she just doesn't know what it is and what it means and has to live like that.
I wanted to ask you about writing about health anxiety specifically, because it's such an interesting one, isn't it? Because we all will eventually get sick. We all will eventually die. I mean, this is an inevitable thing. And it's interesting the way it plays out for Rocky, in that almost you can see perhaps there's even a tiny bit of relief when it does turn out this initial rash that she finds turns out to be a bit serious, because it's like, see, I was right to worry, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like a confirmation that that I was right to be anxious about this, even though, of course, she doesn't want to be sick. Of course she doesn't.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think, right, and how very quickly, like, health sort of recedes, you know, like it's in a film on a dolly, like zooming back away from her. And I think that experience of feeling like very quickly you spiral into this world where you're suddenly taking a ton of medication and being scanned every minute. And I feel like it's that, just what you were saying, that we all will be sick. And it's so, there's something so, it's both inevitable and then completely astonishing when it's you know, that you know it only abstractly and rationally, but when it is in fact unfolding and you're confronted with your own mortality in a very, you know, it's one thing to be like, oh, I'll probably live till I'm like 85, whatever. And then it's another thing to be like, oh, my life is finite. And I'm really feeling that. It's just, I think, a very startling thing. And I think Rocky's just like in that moment, you know, the, I'm just forgetting her name. Never mind. I was going to quote something, but I can't remember the quote or the person who said it. So it's probably not really going to be that interesting. Turning into my own parents, where you're like, what were you reading? And my dad will be like, well, I can't remember the name of the book or the author, but I think you would really like it. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll look for it, Dad. I'm going to look for it. Like, I'm just like that now.
I know. I am 100% becoming that person. 100%. I would love to talk to you about humor. We talked about this last time, that about how, like, what a bodily, visceral experience, like, reaction I had reading We All Want Impossible Things. I laughed so, so hard in that book that I disturbed other family members. But actually, when I was reading, I read Wreck over the Christmas break, and my husband was in the bed next to me. And once again, was like, what are you reading? Because I was shaking the bed with my laughter.
So glad. Thank
and I was like, Catherine Newman. He went, oh, yeah. I mean, that tracks. You know, that is the point we're at. But I was just trying to think, like, whenever I try and describe your books to someone who hasn't read you, I'm like, it's basically like a life challenge or difficulty that's, you know, really difficult, but also something that lots of us will face, plus funny. So your first book is like caring for a dying best friend plus funny, and then a sandwich is like, you know, the complexities and sort of horrors of fertility and losing fertility plus funny, and now this one is like midlife anxiety plus funny.
I'm really glad. Thank you for that. Yeah, I know. It's so weird. I was just doing an event when I was in the UK, Rachel Joyce, and I just love her so much, obviously. Like, who doesn't love Rachel Joyce? Like, I would like move into her house if she invited me. But I was doing an event with her in Ilkley, and in the Q&A, someone said to me, like, why isn't wreck as funny as sandwich? I was like, I don't know. It was supposed to be. Those questions where you're like, because like I'm stupid. I have no idea why.
I found it hilarious. Okay. I mean, I was
Thank
shaking
you.
The bed
I'm
laughing.
I know I trolled for that. yeah, I do think it's funny. I really just think that I think that because part of the way I work has to do with I have pages and pages of notes of all the funny things people in my family say, like daily. And when I sit down to write a novel, I print that out. And so the truth is that a novel is really just a casing of every funny thing anyone in my family has ever said. And I just have to like create a little bit of structure so that I can shovel all of it in. And so I think that the reason they're like that is because that's really what my life is like. Like everyone in my family is the same, not coincidentally. Like my husband and I raise kids to be just like us. So something terrible is unfolding and everyone is like laughing their heads off. So I just have a ton of stolen funny lines that exist for me to pilfer.
That is really interesting because I was actually going to ask you, I adore dialogue in books. I absolutely love books riddled with dialogue. And you write with a lot of dialogue, which is one of the reasons why I love you so much. But I wondered if you took a lot of inspiration from film and from plays, because I feel at times in rec that I'm in a play. That's what it feels like. I'm practically in a play. The Thanksgiving scene, for instance, in rec felt to me like I was at the theater, like in a really good way. And I wondered if that was one of your influences, but maybe it is more just because your influences are coming from, you just obviously have such an ear for dialogue and you like to collect it almost like a magpie maybe.
Oh, I think I do collect it like a magpie. I love that. I knew you were going to say things I wanted to write down, but I forgot to grab a pen. Yeah, I think it's much more about living conversationally than about film or theater. But it's true. I think when you're writing a scene, I don't know if this is true for all writers, but there is a way you see it unfolding as if it is a scene. Like you're writing, you're transcribing something that you're almost watching. And I think that must come from film and theater. I mean, that experience of writing something as if you're watching it being staged. Maybe that's what that is.
Yeah. But it's more real. But the inspiration itself is coming more from real dialogue.
It's usually really coming from real dialogue. And because these characters are obviously so closely based on people I know, it's often very easy for me to imagine what these people would say to each other in different situations. I mean, even if they haven't literally said it, often it's just things that people have literally said. But if they haven't, I can picture it, certainly.
Yeah. Well, it's so wonderful because each character has such a distinct way of speaking as well. Like the father in Wreck, who I read in your acknowledgements is basically your dad. And he would like you to talk a bit more about his great career, which I thought was great. Feel free to talk about it here if you want to. And we can share the podcast with him.
Thank you for that.
But yeah, it's that each person has such a distinct kind of voice. And I guess that's why I guess it's such a joy to revisit those characters again and spend time with them.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is there any chance we might once again revisit them? Or you don't have to talk about it if you don't want to talk about it.
Penny, that is such a good question. It's really a question I also have. I am working on something, but I'm not totally sure it's the same characters yet. Certainly, it'll be at least characters that are similar to these characters because I have no imagination. I just cannot. People who do like world building in a novel, I can't imagine it. Because as you know, like We All Want Impossible Things is also these characters. Like they have different names. And one of the kids both kids are daughters in that book, but it's like the same book. I mean, let's be real. So we'll see. We'll see. But thank you for asking about it.
One of the things I loved that you talked about was this idea of family culture. And obviously you write family culture so beautifully. But Rocky sort of describes this absolute delight and pride when her adult kids do things that she knows is their family culture. And it was so funny. I hadn't seen it articulated before, but it makes me so happy when my teenager, occasionally overhear the teenager talking to other teenagers. And I'm like, they're talking about our family culture. Makes me
right?
so happy.
Yes, because you know that the other possible thing they do is distance themselves from family culture. Like it is a vote of confidence. It feels like it. And it's a way of feeling like, yeah, there's something so, I guess it's like a little clannish, but just something that feels so like tight and close about spending time with adult kids who continue to like share some of your values and interests, even as they are frantically pedaling away from you trying to say they don't. I mean, which I think is so like age appropriate. And I think it's so funny. The lamb, there's a conversation in Wreck where Rocky's son is confessing to actually liking lamb, even though it's not part of their family culture. That was lifted directly from Life. We literally had that conversation. My husband was so offended by this. He was like, no, we hate lamb. And our son was like, no, I'm trying to tell you I actually really like it. And I just think stuff like that is so delicious, where they are differentiating from you, but in the most benign way. Where I'm saying to my husband, like, let's give him lamb. Like, he can have that.
He can have it. He can have it. He can have that one thing.
Yeah, like, he's not voting for Trump. Like, all he's doing is liking lamb. We can let him. It's okay. We can be incredibly gracious about it. We can ask curious questions about his love of lamb, like, non-threatening to us. But my husband was like, no, I can't hear about it, and I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, I would love to ask you a little bit more. Now, we talked a bit before about your freelance writing life, and I'd love to ask you about Substack, because that is something that's grown since we last spoke. You've been a freelance writer for a really long time, and I want to ask you about how it feels now to essentially own your own publication.
No one has asked me that, and thank you, because it's the best. It is so, it feels so hard won to me to get to this place where I could not only just write whatever I want, but actually have readers. And also because it's free, I mean, people choose to pay for it, which I love and helps me like do other stuff. So it's an amazing, I mean, I'm so grateful to the people who pay for it, but you don't have to pay for it to read it. It is technically a free Substack. And then I don't have any like weird guilt. I don't owe anybody anything. Like, I feel like if you want to complain that I'm not writing enough or you don't like it, like just unsubscribe. It's fine. Like I just feel this incredible, like I really don't answer to anybody. And it's the absolute greatest thing. It is even more, in some ways, even though I write the books and my publisher is so, both in the US and the UK, everyone is so supportive. Like they buy the books because they love them, not because they want me to be different. But Substack, like I really don't answer to anybody. There's not like a board of trustees or I don't know. It's so great. That's it. Wow. I have nothing interesting to say besides that it's like the greatest and that I could write about like beans every week and you know, you could watch your numbers fall off. Like if you write like third week with like another hummus recipe and, you know, people are like unsubscribing, whatever. But it's just mine to run into the ground if that's what I'm going to do.
No, I love that. I love that because it's you've written obviously across so many topics in your freelance career. And the idea now that there is a home that you can put anything you want into. And that if people, because you have this gorgeous, strong voice, people who like your voice will just go with you, right? Like, and if they don't, they can unsubscribe.
Right? They're going to go to my colonoscopy with me, it turns out. Like, I mean, whatever. It is great. They're going to like go and talk to my gynecologist about vaginal dryness. They're going to go and either make or not make this chickpea curry, like whatever. It is so wonderful. And I know that Substack itself as a platform is maybe problematic, but for me, just the fact of having an independent way to put things out with this optional, like monetizing strategy, it's so, I feel like I started my own record label. Like it's so thrilling.
And have you found a bit of a sense of community there in the sense of the interaction that happens with readers, but also with other writers on Substack as well?
Yes to both. And some of the people on Substack who comment are people who have been reading me since I wrote this Ben and Birdie blog like 20 something years ago. And they comment with the same like handle. I'm like, oh my God. Like we have been together in conversation for so long. It's amazing. And that community is amazing. And I just, Substack has been so great for me. It's been so, I think the freedom of being just wholly unedited, of being completely the way you want to be. And obviously, you're still performing a version of yourself. Like, there's no such thing as transparency. You're always picking words. You're shaping a story. You're connecting stars in a constellation. You're never just like divulging stuff transparently, but it feels as close as it could be to just like the person I am. And I do really love that.
Oh, well, everyone go subscribe. Crone Sandwich, which by the way, what an awesome title. I feel like so anyone much. Over a certain age is attracted to that title. Like it's like, oh yeah, this is going to be for me.
I drew the illustration for it when I was at my day job. I just want to say, I'm like the worst person. I was literally drawing that at my desk at my day job. I drew that like woman between two pieces of bread.
So good. It's such a good illustration. I love it so much. So this kind of brings me to what I wanted to ask you as we're wrapping up, which is that a lot has changed over the last 3 or 4 years in really exciting ways. But like, what does it mean for you day to day in terms of your week, you know, between, do you still have your day job? You have your day job. Do you still do a bit of freelancing? You're writing novels. You've got your Substack. What does your writing week look like now? Are you one of those people that are like, I do certain things on certain days, or you do a little bit here, a little bit here of everything every day? Like, what does that look like for you now?
Great question. I am a person who does everything every day, but if I'm writing, I have to write first.
Yeah.
One thing that is ironic about becoming moderately successful at this point in my life is that it actually gets in the way of the time I would have to write. So I'm traveling more and I'm doing more things that have sprung from my writing, but that in fact fill in the time I would typically have to write. And that's an irony familiar to writers I know in general. So I'm trying to figure out, like, I do think I have a novel that I want to write, and I've been working on it in the non-writing ways, which are the note-taking, the organizing. But I really need, like, a chunk of time. I'm understanding now why people go to, like, whatever, those writing colonies or retreats, because I feel like what I need is some unbroken time to do the actual work of writing. So I guess I'm still trying to figure it out, like how to balance. It's just what we were talking about before, the balancing of saying yes to stuff. And I love to be a person who says yes to stuff. It's not an inconsequential part of my life that I mostly have said yes to things. That's mostly how every good thing has happened to me is. So I'm very cautious. Like, I don't want to, in fact, disrupt the thing that is what has sustained me. But I also think I'm going to need to figure out how to do this, because this isn't quite getting it done. But I will say that, I mean, just to be totally, really transparent about this piece of it, because it's so hard to talk about and awkward, but having more money now than I used to, you know, I am the primary wage earner in my family. I have been all along as a freelance writer, which is a piece of craziness. And having more money because of books being successful that lead to things like paid speaking gigs is so altering in only good ways. And I just wish that for everybody. It is so life-changing, not even the way of organizing time or doing more things that I like versus things that I have to do, but also just that drumbeat of financial stress that I have listened to for the last 30 years is really quieter now. I still like worry about money, obviously, but I just don't have that. I don't wake up like panicked about it in the same way. And that is completely life changing to me.
What an incredible thing to experience, you know, after working for so long in a career, to experience that kind of just, it's just having that safety net and the backup, right?
Just a little bit of stability.
Yeah, just that, you know, that you could, if you needed to, say no to the next few things that came in
without, and it would be okay.
Yeah, and without completely destroying your finances. Yeah.
Exactly that. Instead of like, shoot, I have the flu and this thing is due tomorrow and I guess I'm just going to write it. Like that feeling of like,
you can take some sick days.
I could take a sick day. I mean, it's really, I can't really express how life-changing that is. Yeah. Like, it's the most incredible gift.
It's really funny, isn't it? I think because I have been a freelancer since I was about 24. And before I was a photographer, before I was a writer, I was a photographer, and now I'm a writer. But so it's like, you know, my whole kind of most of my adult life, I've been freelancing. But trying to explain it to other people that haven't spent their whole life hustling for the next bit of creative work. And this idea of like, you could take sick days. I mean, yeah, I mean, that is right? huge, right? What a kind of incredible gift that your novels have given you, like, you know, and that you have given yourself, obviously.
No, I know. It's so true. And even, I mean, and you know this from the hustle, like, it's the hustle to get the gig, to do the gig, like to get the assignment, to write the thing, and then to spend the next 8 months chasing after the payment for it. Like, it's so epically involved. I mean, and the edits and the, it's all so time consuming. And so if you can carve out a little of that, it just is so chasing after payment. There is nothing more soul sucking than to write like a third email about an amount that's like 150 pounds. That amount. You know, you're just chasing after, and you're at some point you're like, well, it's no longer worth it, but I've already invested all this time in chasing after.
Exactly.
Like, I'm not going to quit now. Anyways, yes.
Oh, wow. I am so thrilled that you've put these novels out in the world for all of our sake. But I'm also thrilled that it's given you that little bit of freedom and space as well.
Thank you.
And long may it continue. I would be very happy to read more Rocky.
You're so nice.
In case you're checking in with people.
Thanks, Sammy. Taking a little audit. I really appreciate it. I feel so like profoundly understood by you. It brings me such a like calm feeling. I love getting to talk to you. Thank you.